It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. As a writer and lover of the Alaska's outdoors, I'm always fascinated when I read something that captures what's really special and important about our state and the activities like hunting and fishing that connect us to its wild places. It's not easy to do in words because these are physical activities that provide meaning, and if you could get that meaning just from someone telling you about it, you wouldn't need to go out in the first place. When someone does capture a bit of that magic on the page, it's worth paying attention to. So I was really impressed when I began reading a newspaper column about hunting written by my guest today, and also by the way they brought their perspectives as a couple to their experience of the outdoors and the way they described it. I got to sit down for an interview with these remarkable writers and outdoors people, and I'd like to share that with you today on Outdoor Explorer. Well, my guests are here with me in the studio, and I'm really excited to have them because I've really enjoyed the column. Steve Meyer is here.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Afternoon. And Christine Cunningham.
Good morning, afternoon.
Right. And of course, we always pre-record, but they came up from Kenai to talk here in Anchorage, and I'm really excited to have them because I've been enjoying the column so much, learning a lot about hunting and also just vivid writing about the outdoors. And maybe I'll start with you, Steve. What is your background as a writer? Because you're a good storyteller and sort of you bring those pictures to life.
Well, thank you. My background, frankly, isn't a lot. I just, growing up, my dad was an avid reader, and so I read a lot. And of course, a lot of it had to do with hunting and the outdoors. And through that, I kind of developed this desire to be a writer in that regard. But life kind of took over, and I worked like everybody else. But the first time I actually tried to write professionally and got published was in 1994. That was for Law and Order magazine.
Oh, really?
I was on a SWAT team, and I wrote an article about that. And then, like I say, life kind of took over, and I didn't do much until it was about 2007 or 8 after I browbeat Christine into submitting some stuff, then I thought, maybe I should get back into it. I've just been kind of doing it ever since.
There's something about the outdoors that this creates a topic, and there's your love is in there, and so it's not like it's an easier topic to write about in one way because you know so much about it, and it's something you're enthusiastic about and focused on, and
there's no stress. I love every aspect of it, and I have my whole life. So it's the nuts and bolts of it are maybe the hard part for me because I've just kind of muddled my way through it and got lucky.
You're doing pretty well. And one of the things that I've liked about your column is that some of them sound like we're sitting around the campfire together and you're telling me a story. And that's what really makes good reading. I mean, maybe that's where some of this stuff comes from.
Without a doubt. And that's kind of, my intent is just to have a conversation. And I'm glad that it's coming off that way.
I think so. So Christine, tell me about your background as a writer and as an outdoor writer. How did this come about for you?
Well, my writing has not been, or my hunting background has not been so long as Steve's, but definitely as a kid, I like to be outside, and I summer camp one year. I wasn't earning a badge in fire or shelter or any of the other things, and I was thinking I was a complete failure in the outdoors. And then there was the haiku badge that you could earn, and they took us out into the woods and said, nature is going to be your source of inspiration, and just listen and see what it tells you. And I was a natural. I could write haiku. I think that started nature being really my source for truth and inspiration. And so naturally, when I went hunting for the first time, my eyes were wide open, having been formerly a vegetarian.
Oh, really?
Yes. And also always hiking and kayaking and having sort of a visitor view of the outdoors, to experience it at the ground level and be in the muck and the smells.
Suddenly you're part of that ecosystem.
Yes, and the cold. And to be a participant was something so worth sharing.
That is such a good point. And did Steve introduce you to hunting?
He did. He was recovering from a surgery, and he was maybe towards the end of a career, and he just, I guess, had an eye opening and decided he wanted to go hunting again after not spending many years. And I thought, well, gosh, if it, something means that much to him, maybe it's worth going along.
Uh-huh.
And so I went along on a duck hunt, and I remember he takes me out, and I'm in borrowed gear, and I'd gone to the range and shot a little bit, and it was raining, and I said, are we still going to go? It's raining.
Right.
I had no idea. That's like perfect. And we get out there, and we see these widgeon 400 yards away on a pond, and he says, we're going to have to get low. We're going to sneak up on these widgeon. And I was, okay, so we're crouching along, kind of like Elmer Fudd.
Uh-huh.
And then he says, we're going to have to get on our knees. I'm like, okay. So I'm inching along, and there's like, it's in a marshy area where the tide's out, so there's like salmon remains, mm-hmm. and it's pretty gross, and spider webs are like all dew-filled in the polar grass, and
uh-huh.
this is kind of gross, and I'm seeing shrews running through, and
mm-hmm.
I'm inching along, and he says, we're going to have to crawl. And so I'm thinking,
this is one way to have a date, right?
Is this when you quit? We're going to have to crawl? So I tuck in my shirt and put on my gloves, and I start crawling, and after a little bit, I feel a tug at my heel, and he says, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm crawling. And he'd never seen anybody crawl so fast in his life. Like, I took off like I was in a diaper derby. I just wanted to get there.
Uh-huh.
And we were at the edge, and the widgeon were looking at me out the side of their head the way they do, and they lifted up, and I shot without really doing anything the way I was supposed to be doing it, and they flew away, and Steve picked up the shell and held it up to my nose, and he says, this is what fall smells like to me.
Mm.
And I don't know, it was one of those things where you're just thinking, gosh, this is a big something. And because fall only ever smelled like school supplies to me.
Mm-hmm.
So this was really cool. And I'm really glad I wanted to go again and find out more.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's so, I'm hearing so many things from what both of you are saying that speak to your storytelling ability. And one of them is like these great little details that you bring out, you know, like the spider webs and everything, and the, you know, all those factors that go into it, and kind of the senses that you have when you're outdoors, when you're hunting or you're fishing, that's, you're sort of taking in what's going on there, right?
Everything.
And you're, and it's, Steve, it's true. It's like when you're hunting or fishing or whatever, it's tuning you into the environment more than if you were just there.
I don't think there's any question of that. And it's part of the process. And it's, mm-hmm. we talk about that a lot. And one of the things that, I think it's important, and in some ways it's kind of become a little bit of a lost art, is that building a relationship with the environment you're in. And,
mm-hmm.
and that's but all of that is, it comes with all the observations, all the things you see, because you're so, it's like you're hyper focused on
mm-hmm.
on
mm-hmm.
everything going around, and not just the life form, but not just the animals that you're hunting, but everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one time we were this tidal flat we hunt ducks with on sometime. Well, we knew it was going to be a high tide, so we had chest waders on. We were going to go out and experience this tide. It was supposed to be like a 24 and a half foot tide. Well, we get out there and the tide's coming in, it's coming in. Pretty soon we realize that either we made a big mistake or somebody else did, but it wasn't stopping at 24 and a half.
Oh,
so,
my gosh.
So we're literally to the brim of our waders.
Uh-oh.
So we managed to get into this duck blind that was out there, and we got up on the benches that were in the duck blind. So we're basically now we're stuck in the middle of this ocean. There's
right.
oceans all around us. And we're sitting there, standing there, and this little vole comes swimming in, and he's like dying.
Too, huh?
I mean, he's and so I picked him up, and he's shivering and I'm holding him, you know, and I'm now all of a sudden I'm going to save this little bull.
Uh-huh.
So I we sat there and this little guy, he was, and pretty soon he calmed down and everything seemed fine. And so I set him on the lip of the blind and, but it was just one of those things, yeah. You know, it's just cool.
We're all in this together.
We're
right?
all in this together. Uh-huh. Out here. And, but,
well, I want to ask you about introducing, Christine told the story of you introducing her to hunting.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in your perspective because I know a lot of guys like may not even want to share their hunting experience with their significant other, or they may not respect that person really enough in terms of those like putting a gun in her hands and taking her mm-hmm. out. You know what? How did that come about for you?
It's an interesting thing because I had tried to introduce other females mm-hmm. in the past, and frankly, it never worked out very
mm-hmm.
well.
It sounds like Christine's pretty tough, so that's good.
Well, she's very tough.
Yeah.
And most importantly is her attitude is she'll try anything. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And I've literally never had a partner so willing to do what I'm wanting to do. But in the past, when I had taken female hunters, what I did was I catered to them every whim. I mean, and
try to placate, and try make it
every
all nice,
yeah, make everything wonderful, mm-hmm. and it never was. And
right.
So when Christine expressed an interest, I just did 180, and I said, "Okay, you want to go? We'll go. We're gonna go to the range. You're gonna see if you can shoot. If you can hit anything, I'll take you. And this is what's gonna happen. This is how it's gonna be." I treated her like she was one of the guys, like uh-huh. a hunting partner.
Uh-huh.
And much like, you know, when I was 6 years old, I was crawling through the mud behind my dad because yeah. I just loved being there. And I figured she's either going to love it or she's going to hate it.
She's probably not, so. Don't, and, yeah.
But,
yeah.
you know.
But she does, yeah.
Let the chips fall. And
Christine, getting into hunting, what do you think is the barrier to it? Because it's not obviously, I mean, there's a lot more women hunting now than there used to be, but it's still not as much as men, obviously.
Right, and I think about that a lot. I think that one of the things I read that sounded true to me was that, and this is a generalization, women versus men kind of a thing, but it's this research I was reading said that in terms of participation, that men tend to see new experiences as a challenge, and women tend to see new experiences as a threat. And so one of the things I think that is huge in terms of women having more interest in hunting is that, for one, I think women are in a position now where they're able to mm-hmm. have more time to explore these things. And the other is that there's the outdoor world sort of caters to women participating. There's Becoming an Outdoors Woman. There's all these groups. You can have a support network of other women who are interested.
Right. You're not a weirdo anymore.
Yeah, you're not a weirdo anymore. So you're more able to participate in a safe environment. Gun ranges, gun safety, mm-hmm. everything. There's a lot of structure to start you off in a way that's not threatening. In terms of interest, I really love the possibility of perspective that women bring to the outdoors, because for so long the stories, the really good stories, I love Hemingway and a lot of these writers, and they're sometimes considered misogynistic or whatever.
The heavy macho,
yes,
sort of
I'm
dudes.
Yes, I'm a very tough man.
uh-huh.
But the really interesting thing is I think women tend to be more holistic in their approaches. Mm-hmm. So when they're viewing environments, or even hunting, you hear a lot, you know, it's very much about the food, or it's very much about being self-sufficient and sustaining. And so I really like that women can bring more of that in, sort of maybe the maternal aspects mm-hmm. of hunting into the conversation. Not because men don't feel the same way oftentimes, it's just the stories that they're not hero stories when they come from women typically. They're more... just personal.
Well, I like that. So the hunting story, the fishing story doesn't have to be the hero story. It doesn't have to be the the exaggerated, obvious lie, all that stuff, right? It could actually be maybe a story about vulnerability and about the challenges you faced.
Absolutely.
And that actually makes for better writing, doesn't it?
I think it does, because, I mean, I love the hero stories too,
mm-hmm.
But I don't love them for the hero part. I love mm-hmm. them for everything else, like Hemingway. I mean, there was a lot of heart in that, you know, you hear the bravado,
yeah.
but there was also something else that made that a strong story, and that was those powerful observations.
Mm-hmm. That you can almost taste it, right? You can smell and taste and see what
very
he's talking
raw,
about.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I really loved, and mm-hmm. the other stuff I didn't really love, it was besides the point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think strong female writers are going to share these observations, but maybe the story sounds different. It's a different plot than sort of the hero journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. Really having an interesting conversation today with Steve Meyer and Christine Cunningham. They write that column that's in the ADN every week. They go back and forth trading about hunting and guns. And how unusual to find a couple who are both such terrific writers and both have this amazing passion for hunting in the outdoors in Alaska. So I'm really enjoying our conversation. Steve, Christine was talking about this, the kinds of stories that we tell, and that they don't often have to be sort of macho hero stories. And I think that's true, because, good heavens, we've been reading outdoor stories for so long, and we've been hearing guys brag about what they shot or what they caught. And it brought to mind something you and I were talking about before the show, a column you wrote about being a young man,
mm-hmm.
going out for your first hunt on your own. You first go after a big bear. It turns out to be a porcupine. I laughed out loud when I read that. And then your mother jerks you back in and you don't complete the hunt. I mean, that's a really good example of what she's talking about, isn't it? That,
yeah.
like, putting your vulnerability on the line is part of this.
For sure. Yeah, you are.
And, yeah. How do you choose these stories that you're going to tell in the paper?
I'm sorry?
How do you pick what you're going to write?
Yeah. You know what? Sometimes it's the time of year,
mm-hmm.
you know, if there's something going on and I have something that from my experience that will relate, mm-hmm. that's one way. And other times it can be what's going on in the news, or is there, you know, something's happened with fishing game or whatever will
right.
trigger.
Some of these columns are pretty straightforward technical information people need.
They are.
And other ones are going to be where your personality is really there,
yeah,
and there's the word I is used quite a bit.
And,
yeah.
you know, the truth is the technical stuff, I mean, I can do that in my sleep practically.
Mm-hmm.
And so
yeah.
those I'm hopefully the readership enjoys them, and I think they do.
Oh, I think so, yeah.
But the ones I really prefer to write are the stories and,
mm-hmm.
you know, my Christine and my experiences. And just because it's just such a awesome world out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're open to sharing it, which is great. Was there any, did you ever feel like not, you know, a lot of people don't want to share their favorite fishing spot. They also don't want to share sort of the secrets of their experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't seem to be a problem you have.
No, I'm not going to pinpoint where you should
right,
go to
of
do
course.
This, but I really, I enjoy, putting out there stuff that's worthwhile
mm-hmm.
through experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the saying about, you know, bad experience is how you learn. And that's true,
mm-hmm.
you know, and sometimes I can tell stories that relate to.
I feel totally the same way. You know, I remember when I was first learning to drive my boat, and I like rammed into the dock 100 times.
Right.
And my cousin was visiting. He says, you know, Charles, I think there's probably books that tell you how to do this. But in fact, you know, now I drive the boat fine. I see other people ram into the dock, and I try not to think, like, what an idiot. I think, like,
right.
Everybody has to learn.
Everybody
right?
has to go. Yeah, you have to do it.
Now. Everybody has the first time.
One of the things that growing up in the hunting world and just about everything else was I had a dad who was. He let me rise to my own level. I mean,
mm-hmm.
if I wanted to try something, go ahead. I mean, and I literally grew up thinking there was nothing I couldn't do because of,
mm-hmm.
Probably because of that. So, you know, I'm willing to make the mistakes
mm-hmm.
to try new things. And, you know, the boat driving thing, I've never been very good at that either.
Yeah, well, but then with Christine, you're kind of teaching somebody who's already an adult to do it, and that's a little bit different, isn't it? Because there's a, also in a relationship, it is
a bit different.
Yeah,
but with Christine, she loves to be taught. Mm-hmm. It's kind of amazing. She's one of the, back when I was still in law enforcement and I had to go to training, I would hate it. I've been doing this for 20 years.
Nobody can tell me. Right.
Where she's one of these people that, she'll do it every day. She just loves it. She's like a sponge and she just soaks it up.
This guy must be a pretty good teacher too, huh?
he's a good teacher, yes. Sometimes I will admit that I could learn more. Sometimes he doesn't tell me enough.
Did you find it intimidating at all when you're first getting into learning to shoot and hunt and do all this stuff?
Yes and no. The parts that were most intimidating for me involve firearms. Mm-hmm. Just because they're dangerous, and I learned shooting at a range, so it wasn't this sort of outdoor fun atmosphere. It was a very serious, regimented, and also there was an audience. So I spent a couple years at the trap range on Sundays getting good at shooting a shotgun. I really love wing shooting. So it was pretty intimidating to show up there. I think at the time I was the only female shooter that was routinely there on Sundays.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And it was a pretty tough crowd. I felt great after a while being one among them. And actually, it took me longer than a person should be proud of to shoot 25 straight, but I got there. A couple of years.
But you stuck with it?
I did, yeah.
Yeah. So and there
she,
was... Yeah.
She won't say this, but after really it was about 18 months... She was shooting on a regular basis as good as anybody out there, and it was pretty cool to see that.
Yeah, that is cool.
In fact, it was for me. It was awesome.
Uh huh.
Because I didn't browbeat her, or tell her you got to do this, you got to do that. As oftentimes that can be real detrimental. Mm-hmm. What I would always tell her, she would, she'd have a string of misses, and she'd be like grumbling, and I'd say, well, remember when you hit that one? And she's like, yeah. And I'd say, just do that.
Right.
It's really simple. Just do that.
You get that feeling back, that flow, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not easier said than done, I suppose.
Right. The advice was all sort of like that. It was this esoteric like advice. Right. Zen. Like, I'm not sure if I understand the advice unless, I already know what you're saying.
Uh-huh.
Like, the guys would say stuff like, just shoot where you're looking.
Okay, yeah.
Right.
And then eventually you figure out what that means after you know how to do it.
Now I know what that means, but yeah. I remember at the time they would say these things and I'd just be thinking, well, that doesn't mean anything. Like, of course, but what?
Yeah, right, right. Well, you stuck with it, I guess, partly because you're enjoying it so much, right?
I was, and I think there's a challenge too whenever there's a gap. When there's a place you see yourself where you can be, and then there's the place you are.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, I want to be on that edge of myself, no matter what I'm doing. Where, I do close those gaps, and so to have not done that would have felt unfinished. Mm-hmm. So I was compelled.
Yeah. So it's coming up to fall here, and you guys must have all kinds of plans. And I'm sure you're fishing like crazy too. Tell me about what your life is like right now. I mean, so you could start, Steve.
It's just, it never stops. Well, we have 9 hunting dogs.
Oh, my gosh.
So that should tell you right up front that we're really busy.
And yeah.
The most important day of the year is Thursday. That's the opening of upland bird hunting.
Okay.
We have all these, we have 7 English setters and 2 chocolate labs. The labs are the waterfowl dogs, but... right now, that's our focus. Is we have, and Maxie, my column this week is about him, Winchester. He's out in the car right now.
Oh, really?
But he's like the show pony of setters, as far as we're concerned. This dog, if there's birds, he finds them, and so we'll be going into the high country, and there's a very good chance we won't take any birds because
and we're pre-recording, so this is already this has already happened. Just the people,
right? Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
But for us, just being out there and watching those dogs do what they do is such an important part of it. But on the horizon, there's a lot of different things. This year, we're still going to try to get a Kodiak deer hunt in this year, although we don't know if we'll be able to do that. But we don't really go out on a lot of trips. I mean, we do it on our own.
You're already here in paradise, right?
We are, and so there's no reason, and we have, we're fit. Fortunately, we have our health, we have our the ability to just go walk and go do what we do, and so there's never a shortage, whether it's bird hunting or moose hunting, although what we found is between the birds, the fish, we can't take a lot of big game because we can't eat it.
You got too much food.
We just got too much to eat, so we really don't take a lot of big game. Of course, waterfowl season. Last year, we got the wind taken out of our sails. At that time, we had 11 dogs. We lost two of them this past year.
Oh, no.
Yeah, both of them very old. Mm-hmm. It was that time. But Gunner, he was our champion chocolate Labrador retriever.
Mm-hmm.
And he got cancer. And we, we did all the things we could, and even to the point where we had him on chemo, and he actually started coming around. We thought he was going to make one more season, and he didn't. And so we didn't do much waterfowl last year.
That's because you didn't have the heart for it.
Yeah, we just didn't have the heart, because that's so much of what that's all about. And Christine, I mean, she's the same way.
You've got a real partnership there, don't you, Christine? When you're hunting with dogs, I mean, it creates a whole new relationship, which maybe mushers might understand, but different from being a pet, or like you're talking about, different from walking through the forest compared to hunting, like a different sort of relationship.
Yeah, and I think musher is a really good question to bring into it. I've talked to Christy Barrington before about dogs. She's a hunter as well, and sort of, I guess when you're doing something with a dog, it's almost like they're a great medium between sort of the wild and the domestic world. It's like they're sort of able to navigate that in a really cool way, and so because you have the relationship with them, it's like you just get closer. The interesting thing for me is when we started hunting with dogs, it sort of changed my focus to where it's almost like I'm doing it for the dog. Like, it's more like it's the dog's hunt than it's my own hunt.
Huh.
And so a lot of times, I'm thinking about what they want and what they're capable of. And I'm sort of like more like a coach. And this is the dog musher analogy as well, where you sort of change from that role of being a solo or hunter or just two people out hunting to where you're sort of like in charge of a team. And so there's these other things, these concerns about, GPS and where's the dog and how's its feet look and, is it picking up anything in its fur and all these other things. Do you have a kit to address things if they come up, other dogs on the trail? It's a definitely, that part of it might seem to take you away and out of the sort of, but in another way it brings you in. So there's definitely room for both hunting with dogs and
own. This whole training aspect and just taking care of 9 dogs. I mean, that's a lot of work, time, and money.
It is a lot of work, a lot of time, a lot of money.
Do you get a really develop a relationship with 9 dogs?
Oh, we have the most fabulous relationship. These dogs are just, you'd actually have to see it, but it's just incredible.
One thing that's a little different, I think, for us is we didn't necessarily choose to be owners of 9 dogs. What happened to us was we had a pair of English setters that could be bred together, and we thought, well, we want we want to have two pairs of setters to change out so we can always be hunting and not exhausting the dogs. And so we bred our two dogs and found out we really don't have the ability to be breeders. Like they were it was a difficult thing to have the puppies. They didn't all make it. It was pretty traumatic for me.
Uh-huh.
And we ended up, how do you pick out? It was like Survivor. How do you pick out which two of this litter you're going to keep now?
Mm-hmm.
And we end up keeping them all. So okay. it's actually a litter of puppies that yeah. compose most of our setters.
Yeah.
And the dynamics of training
it's
litter
a family,
mates
yeah.
is a tough one.
I bet.
They sort of, there's a, you know, you're not supposed to really keep even two from the same litter because they'll bond with each other instead of you. And that's somewhat true with our, we call them the puppies. They're eternally the puppies, no matter mm-hmm. how old they get. They're definitely a super pack in terms of bonding with each other. And when someone, you know, makes a accident in the house, it's a whodunit because
right, nobody's got
right.
Nobody's
you didn't see it happen, and there's five of them. Challenging.
Wow. Well, so much more I want to talk about. We're going to take a break and come back. We're talking about hunting and writing about hunting and guns with Steve Meyer and Christine Cunningham. They live in Kenai. They're kind enough to come into Anchorage to talk, take a quick break out of hunting and fishing, I guess. And they write these columns in the ADN, which I hope you'll take a look at if you haven't already. As you can hear, they've got some really good insights about the meaning of these activities that are so important to us Alaskans, and great observations about sort of some of the deeper levels of it. So we're going to talk for the rest of the half with Steve and Christine. Please stay with us. My name is Charles Wolforth as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we're talking about hunting, fishing, the outdoors with Steve Meyer and Christine Cunningham. They are writers who do a column alternate weeks in the Alaska Dispatch News. They live in Kenai. They live an amazing outdoor life where they share their enthusiasm with each other and with nine dogs. And amazingly, they also make a living. It sounds like they're hunting all the time, but I guess there's also some work out there. Some regular for money work, and I've just really enjoyed our conversation, and we just have another half hour left here to talk some more. Steve, you also write about guns and gun safety and sort of how to be a good shooter,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's such a valuable column to be online and in the paper here in Alaska, where everyone has a gun, but not everybody knows how to use it right.
That's really well said.
Yeah. And you come from a law enforcement background. Is that where you get a lot of your knowledge?
Well, that certainly has advanced my knowledge. I grew up, and my dad was not only a hunter, but he was a shooter. And so, and I was, as a kid, I was like a sponge. All of that stuff was just the world to me, and
mm-hmm.
and I kind of grew up that way. And so I started when we came to Kenai in 71, there wasn't a rifle range, and so I got to be part of the ground floor of a gun club that we started in 1975. And I'm still part of that club. I'm still mm-hmm. on the board of directors, and so through that I got associated with a lot of really good gun people that really knew their way around guns, and between that and I've all the hunting I've done, I've never taken with a factory loaded cartridge. I've always
wow.
hand loaded, starting when I was 11 years old, the first big game animal I took. So it's really a holistic thing for me. It's
mm-hmm.
all involved, and then As I got older and chose the law enforcement profession, well, by that time I was already, at least people tell me, I was pretty good. And so
mm-hmm.
that led to being part of a SWAT team, and which was also really cool. And
yeah.
That's kind of what dreams are made of for a lot of young guys. And so that advanced my firearm skills and knowledge. But, you know, one of the things that I always like to talk about is, you know, firearms get such a lot of bad press, and in some ways, it's understandable. Mm-hmm. People associate the firearm itself with the bad behavior, but really it's people behavior. I think, you know, we know that. But the shooting business, in turn, and aside from, you know, criminal endeavor, the shooting business is much safer than practically anything you can be engaged in. And the biggest reason for that is because people in the shooting world just hammer the gun safety and the right way to do things, and we just relentlessly pursue that, and that's why it is the way it is. And, you know, Christine,
where somebody at home who's got a handgun floating around and really not,
exactly,
yeah, that's where bad stuff
that's
really
bad
happens.
Stuff and, yeah. And so part of what I try to convey in my columns is the responsibility, and mm-hmm. There is more to it than just throwing a gun in the drawer, and there's a lot of things to think about, I think that's really important, and I'm pretty grateful to have the opportunity to share some of that with
you. Well, I think you guys are both Alaskans. I mean, there's an Alaskan tradition that I grew up with, which is that I think of as guns being tools that you need to mm-hmm. live here in Alaska, right? They're not a religion. They're not a toy. They're
right.
not all these other
right,
things, right? They're a tool, and treat them like a tool.
They're very, very, absolutely they are. They mm-hmm. have a purpose, and used right, they'll serve you just like any other tool, mm-hmm. very well.
So what would you like, obviously safety, but what do you find that people need to know about shooting or gun handling that you find that they don't know or that they need to learn more of? I mean, in terms of when you're thinking about putting your message out there.
Well, in terms of being able to shoot accurately, mm-hmm. there's one thing that's almost universal with people having trouble hitting stuff, and that's how they press the trigger. And I mean, that sounds simple, but that is really the key to it. So that's one thing, and I talk about that a little bit.
And tell me what's the secret?
The secret is to let the gun go off, not make it go off. What happens is people and pressing a trigger, and they call it pulling a trigger, but because that's usually what people do. But as you press the trigger and people will say it's a surprise break, you should let the gun surprise you. Because if you don't, like if you make the, if, in other words, if you jerk the trigger even just a little bit, that throws off, because that movement changes where the bullet exits the barrel, where the bullet or the barrel is pointed when the bullet exits the barrel. And this is especially true in handgun. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've literally seen people from me to you, like this close, mm-hmm. hit the dirt in front of them because they're jerking so hard.
And that's it's such a precise action you're making here.
I mean, it's very precise.
Yeah, and so that little the muscle movement there is everything.
And what then to throw in a little bit more into it, when you have to do it at speed, which mm-hmm. you know, if you're wing shooting, I mean, you don't have time to. You know, you have to come up and press that trigger fast, or in a defense type situation, things happen really fast. Mm-hmm. Or even big game hunting, sometimes you have to shoot fast, mm-hmm. but you have to be able to do that and still maintain that surprise.
Calm. Yeah.
So yeah. It's a bit. You know, people say shotgunning is an art and rifle shooting is a science, but there's a little bit of both to all those mm-hmm. things.
And a lot to know. So, Christine, when you were learning this, I mean, this sounds like another one of those Zen things you're talking about, like let the gun shoot itself. What? How did you get comfortable? How did you become, you talked about how you started as this vegetarian, non-shooter woman, and you now are writing an outdoor column. So that's a pretty big journey. How did this come about for you, that you got comfortable with doing this, and that you, obviously there was some joy in it, and some, you told us about how you became inspired, but was there sort of a barrier that you had to overcome?
In terms of the firearm barrier, I think there There definitely was a fear factor for me there, because of it was unfamiliar. And I mean, the best thing to do to make something unfamiliar familiar is to do it a lot. And so different things, you know, just going all the time, every Sunday, every chance I could to shoot shotgun. And then also doing some shooting with 22s because they're small. And so it's a lot of practice, cheap ammunition, getting familiar with something and not developing bad habits from jerking or recoil or whatever. That and dealing with malfunctions and knowing that if something were to go wrong, I could handle it quickly in basically the same kind of gun, but a smaller caliber. So the 22 shooting and the shotgunning were really a great foundation. And then it just got me over all of the, what is this? It was sort of the introduction. And Steve kids me about wanting all this extra training and stuff. But I think the reason I love so much training is just that beginner's mind aspect. And that's why I was interested in the outdoors and opening my mind and experiencing new things. In terms of firearms, I think you have to have respect for, just like respect for taking the life of an animal, you have to have respect for something that can take life as well. Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes I see some casual handling of guns or casual killing of animals, and it's not something I take casually. It's something I take very seriously, and I think it should be taken seriously because it's the big stuff. I mean,
and in a sense, that's when we started at the top. You were talking about how the act of hunting connects you to the ecosystem, connects you to the outdoors in a way you don't get, and handling a really dangerous device does that too. And what I'm picking up from you is that you didn't want to have Steve do it for you. You wanted to be able to be self-reliant, be able to do everything yourself, because that's part of you becoming this person, right? This person who's part of this whole world.
Yeah, and I think, I'm not a mom, so I don't have sort of the having children biological thing to connect me so much to life and death and the cycle and of life. And so in some ways, I want to live as honestly as possible. And if my actions on planet Earth are blindly causing harm to animals in terms of, you know, eating what comes out of a long production line, or leaving a big footprint in terms of my own existence and my use of a car and plastic bottles and so forth. I wanted to take the blinders off and really look at it. You know, if I eat meat, what does it mean to eat meat? What does it mean to go out there and be responsible for that? How can I do that with as much integrity as possible? And so, you know, firearms, I'm interested in bow hunters, you know, and if it were more effective, and it's getting more effective. But yeah, it's, I think it's really important to immerse.
Well, I really respect what you're saying about, like, eating meat from a plastic tray and never knowing what kind of that animal really looked like, as opposed to killing something and then eating it, and that being a much more authentic experience. You said you started out as a vegetarian. How did you get from vegetarian to hunter? I mean, that seems like a big leap, or is it not really not, because it's about integrity?
I think it is about integrity, and I should be fair and say I had like a flirtation with vegetarianism, okay, because I really love meat. I love to eat meat, but I don't want to do it. I want to do it intelligently. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it was a big leap for me. One thing that might be surprising to people is that hunting is not easy. And I don't mean in terms of the skill required. I mean in terms of the conscience involved. I mean, it is hard for me to come up on a game animal that I've killed. You know, it's hard for me. Sometimes I'll hold a bird and it's this very beautiful thing. I love birds. I would never get to hold a bird if I weren't having shot it. Birds don't let you hold them usually. Yeah. And so in some ways it's very intimate, and it's you know, I don't think it's ever easy to take an animal. I know a lot of hunters feel the same way. Maybe they never admit it, and maybe some hunters don't feel that way at all, and it's very much a farm mentality. I'm harvesting something mm-hmm. for food, but I think that answers a little bit.
Very much so. I mean, and I think that's one of the reasons why your writing is so vivid, is because it means so much to you. You're not just going out and doing, it's not as if you're writing about running or you're something, anything else you might be doing. This is very meaningful. Yeah. Outdoor Explorer. I'm talking with Steve Meyer and Christine Cunningham today. They are hunters, outdoors folks who write for the ADN, and they alternate back and forth. They live in Kenai and obviously are totally dedicated to this outdoor lifestyle. Tell me about what you are getting ready for. You mentioned the upland birds, mm-hmm. waterfowl, duck hunting is coming.
Yeah.
I assume you will be out there as the sun rises on the first day of the season.
That's part of the tradition. Mm-hmm. You know, the waterfowl opener for me is probably...
Is that your favorite part of, I mean, is that like one of your favorite days of the year?
There was a time when it absolutely was. Back when we first moved to Alaska, the moose season for a while was open August 20th, and then waterfowl opened September 1st, so I could have both openers. Well, then it changed, and it was September 1st for both. So I always had to make that decision, and it was always waterfowl, because that's what I started on, mm-hmm. was waterfowl hunting. So it's a really big thing. But with that, there's an English setter named Winchester. He's a black and white bundle of awesomeness that has kind of changed that a little bit. Now it's the upland opener waterfowl opener is still very important.
Yeah.
But the upland opener.
So
now,
that's like your absolute, the one and only, huh?
That's it. Yeah. And a lot of that has to do with him, what he does, and where we go. Uh-huh. And it's always in the high country. The birds we hunt primarily with Winchester or white-tailed ptarmigan, they make their living with the doll sheep and the goats.
Mm-hmm.
And so the country we're
in. Beautiful country, yeah.
It's just, there's nothing else like it. There's nothing like the high country.
And physically challenging to get there, too.
It is, and it keeps my old body, keeps it going. Without that, I don't know, I might weigh 400 pounds, but
I kind of doubt that, but you don't have to share with a lot of people also. I mean, you rarely see another
person, yeah. And that's, that's kind of part of it too, is the solitude and the quiet. All of those things are very important.
How far would you normally walk to get to like your camp when you're doing that kind of hunting? Or
a typical day of whitetail hunting, we'll about a minimum of 6 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times double that, but and that's once we're in hunting country, but there's always a climb up, you know, down on the peninsula. There's really no place to drive to high country. So it's always a climb up, and then you start hunting.
Yeah.
Christine will get mad at me sometimes because Winchester will point other upland birds on the way up, and I'm like, no bird, that's not what we're hunting today. She's like, what?
How about you, Christine? Do you feel, is that also your favorite hunt?
Yeah, the upland birds is really, it's really my favorite. And I guess it's a little bit of an aesthetic thing because it's so incredibly moving to see a English setter with the feathers and the morning light through their hair, and the way they can point a bird. And it's Winchester has... I've learned his body language over time is so strong. You know exactly what he's doing, and his tail will helicopter, and then all of a sudden it'll start shaking, and then it turns into like a rattle, and then it goes so frozen, and you know for sure there's a bird. And I've doubted
it. Magical, right?
It is. It really. It just gives you chills. And sometimes I've thought, well, he's wrong. I remember. Oh, that's an old smell or something. I doubt him, especially when you know it's a grueling snowshoe climb, and he points a bird 700 vertical feet above you, and you're just like, that's not a bird. I might have to walk up there and prove it. And I'll have gone up to him. This is so many times, and it. Poor reflection on me, I guess. There's not a bird, and I'll look around. There's no bird. I don't see it, and I'll have almost stepped on it, and it'll fly up.
Oh, wow.
And,
yeah.
And he actually is a little bit of a cartoony dog. The looks he gives you. It's kind of sometimes he looks at you, and this might be anthropomorphism, but you know he'll give you this look like that took you long enough to get here.
Doggy, yeah. That's funny.
It's fun. It's a lot of fun.
So you were talking about the sort of this, the issues of abundance and scarcity with regard to the ptarmigan, and that, you know, you kind of want to hunt somewhere different than where you've been hiking during the summer.
Yeah, I think Steve and I were talking about, you know, what's the criteria for, you know, our best case scenario hunting. And, you know, one thing I get questions a lot about it. I know I'm a hunter, but that doesn't mean I'm a hunter of everything. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that any animal that comes across my path, I'm going to shoot. I'm definitely interested in bird hunting, most of all, and white-tailed ptarmigan. They're probably the most likely to be affected by climate change. They're alpine birds. They're the smallest of the three ptarmigan, and just noticing because of the surveys in the spring, and then following them and seeing them throughout the summer while we're keeping the dogs exercised, we see their chicks and things, and so, you know, come fall, I certainly am not compelled to hunt birds that I watched grow up.
Right.
I'm not a farmer, and so. I mean, I prefer to hunt animals I don't know, mm-hmm. And you know, come upon, and so with whitetail, it is harder and harder for me to hunt them because I do think that they're scarce, especially in pressured areas. Not so much willow ptarmigan and rock ptarmigan seem to be healthy.
Yeah. Thoughts on that, Steve, in terms of like the conservation issues that were?
Yeah, what Christine says is, you know, absolutely true. And I've been roaming the mountains of this country for a long time. And you know, one of the things that we talk about as bird hunters, as hunters, you know, you'll hear, well, hunters don't have any effect on bird populations. And that's simply not true. Maybe in the big scheme of things, mm-hmm. like, and sometimes we, like, for example, a statewide population of whitetails. Well, nobody knows what that is, but presumably, you know, any area that's accessible, we could hunt them out and there'd still be plenty of birds, which, okay, that's probably true. Same with willows or grouse or any of those things. But you can hunt them out of areas, and I've seen it over and over. Mm-hmm. And so... you know, sometimes I think that we get a little carried away on our bag limits, and you know, anymore it's a pretty rare day that we'll take more than a couple ptarmigan, even if it's good, because for those reasons, and mm-hmm. even when we go back,
leaves them for everybody else. Yeah,
yeah, they're exactly, and not just for hunters, but for everybody, because mm-hmm. It's important that those, and the whitetails, they're very near and dear to me because mm-hmm. of where they live. They're just tough little birds. They're the only ptarmigan that spends their whole life above tree line, and so they're special.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you mentioned that you get so much meat from your fishing and your bird hunting that you don't do much big game hunting anymore, but you do pursue them with the camera.
And I do.
I'm curious as to how that feels compared to hunting with a gun. I mean, it's not really the same thing, but it's also a little bit is maybe.
Yeah, you know, and there's a lot of aspects to photography, wildlife photography, that are the same. And one of the things that I think that, you know, people say, well, it's not the same, you're carrying a camera, and that's true, and I believe that there's that animals can detect when you mean them harm. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying this happens to everybody, but I mm-hmm. know it happens to me a lot. Even when I'm carrying a gun, I've approached animals ridiculously close because I'm just wanting to associate with them. I'm not trying to harm them.
They're picking up something about your behavior.
They're picking up something about my presence. And, mm-hmm. But the photography, I mean, yeah, it's true that, you know, if you go to a national park or whatever where they're acclimated to people, yeah, it's not the same as hunting. But
right.
But if you want to go out here and climb a mountain and get photography close to a mountain goat or a doll sheep or a...
It's hard as heck.
It's a whole different game.
And waiting for the sunlight to come through.
Well, yeah,
too,
and
right?
then there's
there
a light.
And it's and gray, right.
So it's... But my hunting, my past experience with hunting has so enhanced my ability to
oh,
do
sure.
that.
Yeah.
Just to be able to find animals, for one thing. So I really, really enjoy that. A lot of the time, we'll take one gun in hunting, and then we'll trade off. One of us will take pictures, and one of us will shoot. And we have a rule. I'll just say this. We have a rule.
I was going to bring up the rule.
if we take a photo of a bird or an animal, it gets a pass. We're not going to shoot any bird or animal that we take a photo of.
Interesting.
That's that.
I think it's interesting.
That.
Your partnership is great and really inspiring and nice to see and comes through in your writing. And I was wondering if you have thought about writing a book together or doing something. You've written all these great columns. That somehow turning that into something where your shared experience it becomes a book or something like that.
I'll let you take that since you're always badgering.
We've talked about a bigger project, and I did write a book, Women Hunting Alaska, and it's definitely a lot of work to put together a book. You know, I tend to be a little bit of a grammar nerd, and he tends to be not interested in criticism.
I see. So you can teach each other about hunting, but about writing, forget it.
I'm not sure how the collaboration
it's gotten better.
Would work. But I do think it's cool, the sort of his and her perspective of the same experience.
Well, I'm just tell me if I'm wrong, but Steve is the storyteller, the yarn spinner, and you're the observer and the person who picks out all these beautiful little details, right?
That might be a good I think that's fair.
And maybe, you know, they put you together, and what you're doing is already great. I love the back and forth, the two different perspectives, and the way that you're developing a relationship with your readers too. You must get some great feedback.
We do, and that's really rewarding.
Yeah,
to get that.
A lot of people need this information and really just appreciate. I mean, when you're at home and you can't be outdoors, to at least read about it.
Yeah.
It's a good step in the right direction. Well, thanks so much. I've really enjoyed this hour. It went by really, really quickly.
Well, thank you for inviting us out.
Yeah,
we've certainly enjoyed it as well.
Oh, good. Yeah, Steve Meyer, Christine Cunningham. You'll find their work in the Alaska Dispatch News. We'll have links and photos on our website at outdoorexplorer.org. Please tune in again next week. Our producer is Eric Bork, assistant producer who helped line up today's show. It's Hannah Doro. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.